Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed agenda today, so I'm just going to rush through what we're talking about. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Ashley Jennifer Parker, spokesperson for Veterans Stand for Standing Rock. And we're going to be talking about the thousands of U.S. military veterans who have volunteered to go to Standing Rock and stand alongside the Native peoples to defend the water protectors from assault and intimidation at the hands of the militarized police force and DAPL security. And we're going to be talking about all this in the wake of the recent decision by the U.S. Army and the government to at least temporarily take a step back in the pursuit of this project. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Raymond Lotta. Raymond's an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism, a political economist, author of American Decline, and writer for Revolution newspaper. 9 days ago, Fidel Castro, leader of the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban uprising that got rid of U.S. imperialism in Cuba, and he led the Cuban state for a very long time, and he died. And right now, there's a lot of people all over the world who are digging into this and trying to figure out what that means and what's happening, and Raymond's here to talk about that. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Michael. I always appreciate the opportunity to speak to your audience.
The world just marked the death of Fidel Castro, and there's been a whole lot of debate around how to assess Castro and the society he built and led in Cuba. What did Castro do in relation to Cuba?
Yeah, the Cuban Revolution really was an extraordinary event. This was the first true revolutionary rising that came to power in the Western Hemisphere, right on the doorstep of U.S. imperialism. And Cuba had been a country that for more than 100 years had been subjected to incredible misery and domination by Western and U.S. imperialism. The U.S., of course, had gotten hold of Cuba, turned it into a colony in 1898. This was the Spanish-American War when the Cuban people were fighting for independence from Spain. And then the U.S. took it over and established Cuba as a vassal of U.S. imperialism. And the conditions in that society were just atrocious. I mean, one was the actual degree of control that was exercised by the United States. You know, 80% of Cuba's utilities, 90% of its mines, close to 100% of its oil, cattle ranches. And the sugar industry, of course, was dominated by foreign interests. And the conditions of people in Cuba, the sugar workers, they had been subjected to grueling, horrible conditions and then long periods of unemployment. And Cuba became this investor's paradise for U.S. gambling syndicates, real estate operators, hotel owners, and mobsters. People in your audience might have seen this in Godfather 2. You know, this was just a playground of the U.S. And in fact, U.S. business forces turned it into a sex tourism center. And there were 100,000 prostitutes in Cuba at the time of the revolution. This is what happened. And the control was exercised through brutal regimes. And Castro led this popular uprising against Batista. And he was the head of this client regime that served the United States. And this was the backdrop for that revolution. These were the conditions that gave rise to that revolution. And it was really an amazing event. In 1959, the revolution came to power. And it had a galvanizing effect on people because, as I said, here in the Western Hemisphere, right on the doorstep, 90 miles from Miami, this revolution came to power. It stood bravely against the United States. And, you know, it summoned others to follow its example. And Cuba really did become an inspiration to people. You know, I'm speaking to you, Michael, and your audience from Harlem, Revolution Books in Harlem. And in 1960, Castro came to give a speech in the UN, and he was being hounded and harassed by the U.S. government. So he just decided he was going to come to Harlem, you know, to see the basic people. And he stayed in this hotel, Hotel Teresa, and was cooking his food. And, you know, the guerrillas were here in their uniform now speaking. And this was the kind of experience and the kind of impact that it had. So this was a truly, truly just uprising against U.S. imperialism. It was a society, an economy that had been twisted and dominated and serving the interests of U.S. banks and corporations. And the Cuban people suffered greatly. And that's why there was a revolution. And Castro led that.
Now, you know, one of the things that's really important in this, too, I mean, you think about this and you think about what was unleashed across the globe, as you were pointing to, you know, and the fact that for a lot of people, Cuba did become this, as you're saying, a source of hope and inspiration and for the oppressed and radical and revolutionary minded people throughout the world. And at the same time, it was like a major smack in the head to the U.S. imperialists. And they actually launched a terrible campaign against the Cuban Revolution in Cuba, right?
Look, the U.S. government, the U.S. imperialists never forgave, and they never let up for what had happened there. And the U.S. government imposed an embargo that made it impossible for Cuba to obtain vital goods and medicines and other critical raw materials and supplies. And the U.S., through the CIA, financed and armed and coordinated the Bay of Pigs invasion, which took place, as I said, in 1961. And this was just mercenaries and thugs who came in to Cuba. They landed on boats and tried to overthrow Castro, and that met defeat. And Castro was constantly subjected to CIA attempts to assassinate him. I mean, you know, they were trying to blow up his cigars, and the U.S. sought through every means to isolate Cuba diplomatically. That was because of the model and the inspiration that it gave to people. And the U.S., you know, was working through all kinds of channels and means internationally, pressuring West European governments to not enter into economic and diplomatic relations, and constantly building up counter-revolutionary forces within Cuba and trying to strangle it from without. So that was the situation. Revolution had come to power, a society that had been dominated and distorted by U.S. imperialism, that was dependent on sugar production. It was a one-crop economy. And here you have an uprising led by Castro, and it's now confronting a world in which imperialism is dominant, and they're trying to use every channel and every means to, as I said, strangle this revolution. And these presented real challenges and difficulties for Castro in the early 1960s.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Lotta. Raymond's an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. He's a political economist, author of American Decline, and a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about the death of Fidel Castro, U.S. imperialism, and what it's going to take to liberate the Cuban people. That's exactly what I was thinking of going in terms of when you think about this, that in the face of all this, it did present a big challenge. And I remember reading different books around, there was the missile crisis that happened and the threat of nuclear weapons being used against Cuba. It was a very heavy situation for a long time. And in the face of this, Castro had to make decisions about what he was going to do, how he was going to handle this. I think this is something that people don't often get. And I think it's something that's very particular in terms of what you've done, the work you've done around this, that actually has dug into this, that Castro actually opted for a whole different policy than one that was actually a policy that would carry out liberation.
This is the crucial question. There were real pressures. And, you know, I've documented and, you know, indicated, and many in your listening audience know the litany of attempts to oust Castro from power. And there was this highly dependent economy. And here is where we have to understand in a much deeper way, at a much deeper level, what Castro did in response to that. He, as you indicate, and I've written on this in Revolution Newspaper and at revcom.us, but in the face of all of that pressure, Fidel actually adopted a policy, a set of policies, a road of development, and an international orientation that whatever his beginning and initial intentions might have been, actually resulted in subordination to imperialism anew, once again. In other words, this revolution that came to power did not ultimately go on to win liberation. And what happened is that Castro was facing an economy that was highly, highly twisted. As I said, sugar was the king of that economy. You know, there had been extensive poverty and very little in the way of all-round industrial development, and agriculture was completely skewed, land to sugar production. And rather than carrying forward a revolution to restructure that whole economic legacy of domination and distortion, what Castro did is he brought Cuba into a dependent relationship with the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union had ceased to be a socialist society in the mid-1950s. And the Soviet Union had emerged as an imperial rival to the West and was luring Castro and offering Castro economic incentives to enter into the Soviet bloc. And that relationship was one that Castro saw as the only alternative to the conditions of dependency that had been created by imperialism, and B, as a way to sort of give Cuba a quick fix. And that quick fix meant perpetuating that whole monoculture of sugar. Cuba did not carry forward an all-round transformation of its economy to create a balanced and self-reliant economy with agriculture, providing the food that could feed the people. It didn't develop light industry and more advanced industry. And what you have in Cuba then is the recreation of conditions of dependency. But the difference was that now Cuba was subordinate to another imperialism, another imperialist network, and that was headed by the Soviet Union. And this was not a society that was empowering the masses of people to carry forward a struggle to uproot all exploitation and oppression, to attack patriarchy and racism, and for this society to serve the cause of advancing world revolution. It came under the thumb of the Soviet Union. Now, the arrangements that were made, you know, Cuba sold sugar, and the Soviet Union now became the prime market rather than the United States. The Soviet Union gave Cuba oil and credits. Cuba would sell that oil. And they just recreated and perpetuated this relationship of dependency. But on the basis of that, they were able to build up some infrastructure of health and education and the welfare programs that Cuba is very known for. But that was the product of subordination to the world imperial system. And the fact is that you had a benevolent sort of welfare state in which, precisely because sugar and the dictates of the world capitalist economy were setting the terms for things, people's labor and their creativity in Cuba was all serving the logic of sugar production. And that hemmed in and chained people to a system economically and socially and politically that was not contributing to the all-round radical revolutionary transformation of society. People were actually sort of powerless. They were politically passive. Yes, they were receiving health care and education. Yes, there was state ownership of factories and enterprises, but that's not the essence of socialism. Socialism is a new political power, a new form of class rule where the formerly oppressed and exploited, in alliance with the great majority of society, are carrying forward a revolution to uproot all oppression and exploitation. It's a new economy that's based on social planning and social ownership, cooperation, and breaking with the dictates of profit and produce, produce, and produce, whatever yields the highest return. But Cuba's economy was still premised on sugar. So this was the situation. So Cuba was not socialist under Fidel Castro. And this is very difficult for people to understand because it called itself socialist. Fidel proclaimed himself as a socialist. But what was happening there was not a process of socialist transformation, because socialism is a new political power, a new state power, the dictatorship of the proletariat, serving the all-round transformation of society and standing up to imperialism and old and new exploiters. And it's empowering people to take responsibility for the direction and increasingly for the running of society. And it's a new economy, as I said, and socialism is a transition. It's a system that's not standing still, but it's moving forward, carrying forward struggle to get to a communist world without classes, without exploitation, no longer patriarchy, no longer the division between those who work with their minds principally and in the realms of art and administration and those who were condemned to be working in the realm of manual labor. This was not the direction that Cuba was going in. It was not a socialist country. But the U.S. still never forgave and never forgot, and Cuba became much more tightly integrated through the 60s and 70s and 80s into the Soviet bloc.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Lada. Raymond's an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. He's a political economist, author of American Decline, and a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about the death of Fidel Castro, U.S. imperialism, and what it's going to take to liberate the Cuban people.
And this is extremely important for people to understand because, again, when you're pointing us out, it's like you can see something different was needed. But a lot of people argue this was the best that they could do. And in fact, it wasn't the best that they could do. And you've written a lot about this. You know, around the world, you're one of the most outstanding people in terms of analyzing what was going on in places like China and what was going on in terms of the development of revolutionary theory and revolutionary leadership in the world at the time. And this is something that actually Castro and the Cuban regime actually didn't turn towards, but in fact consciously rejected, right?
Right. You see, at the time of the revolution in the 60s, early 60s, this also coincided with what was called the Sino-Soviet split, the rift, the Sino-Soviet struggle, Mao Zedong. And this is very critical to understand what happened, you know, in Cuba and assessing the Cuban Revolution and what its actual options and opportunities were and how Castro foreclosed those options precisely because he was looking for that quick fix, trying to build on that dependency to somehow get the oxygen to survive. But this resulted, as I said, in a new form of dependency. But Mao was waging a struggle against what was called revisionism. And revisionism is a distortion of Marxism that guts the heart, the revolutionary heart, out of communism and actually perpetuates capitalism in the name of communism and Marxism. In other words, you have socialist ownership, but this is not genuine socialist ownership. It's ownership of factories, it's the planning of the economy that's guided by principles of profit, and the planning mechanism is following that in terms of prices and quotas and how resources are allocated. Now, Mao Zedong identified the Soviet Union as the center of modern revisionism, you know, the gutting, as I said, of revolution. And he had identified that what had happened in the Soviet Union in the mid-1950s was that a new capitalist class had come to power. And he brought forth this analysis of the Soviet Union as a capitalist society masquerading as socialism. And Fidel Castro went up against that. He took the Soviet side, that the Soviet Union was socialist. And that had everything to do with his ideological outlook and his dependency, because he too saw socialism as simply a welfare state and state ownership with some sort of promulgation of Marxist ideology. But this was a form of dependent capitalism that was developing in Cuba. And Mao had also called out the Soviet Union as an imperialist power and operating on a global scale, that is, after the restoration of capitalism in the mid-1950s, and contending with the United States throughout the world, in Africa and in Latin America, and building up its military and building up an economic network to extract wealth from different parts of the world. Well, Fidel Castro, he defended the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia and Afghanistan. He supported it. He attacked Mao. And of course, what's most important here, and you've mentioned Mao and what was going on in China, is that Mao wasn't just theorizing, you know, the problem and the danger of capitalist restoration. Mao, in 1966, launched the Cultural Revolution in China, which was aimed precisely at preventing the restoration of capitalism, putting society and keeping society on a socialist road towards communism. And the method of the Cultural Revolution was to mobilize tens and hundreds of millions of people to take up the biggest questions of society and of the world revolution, and to be waging struggle to uproot capitalism in all its forms and remnants, and to carry forward revolution in the realm of culture, in education, to transform society in the direction of creating a world community of humanity and creating a society that was promoting revolution. So Mao was bringing forward a whole new understanding that the revolution has to continue, and calling out the Soviet Union as an imperialist power. Castro played a very regressive, harmful ideological role in not only defending but prettifying the Soviet Union. And Mao was opening up a whole other path to carrying the revolution forward. And in fact, Michael and people in the audience, you know, in the 1970s, you know, 1975, what being a communist meant was Mao, Maoism, because Mao had further developed the science of communism. just as Marx had founded it and Lenin had further developed it, Mao had taken it to a whole new level, and that was concentrated in this whole understanding of continuing the revolution under socialism. So Mao had been doing this, and Fidel was opposing it. So there's both the character of what was going on in Cuban society that I've been speaking to, and then there was the ideological role that Fidel was playing, which was a very damaging, regressive, and ultimately reactionary one.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Lada. Raymond's an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. He's a political economist, author of American Decline, and a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about the death of Fidel Castro, U.S. imperialism, and what it's going to take to liberate the Cuban people.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me, I think the last time we had you on the show talking about Cuba, it involved a whole new approach that Obama was taking towards the Cuban regime, towards what the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. And now you have Obama on the way out and Trump coming in. What is the difference between Obama's approach and Trump's approach, and what will it mean?
Well, I think Obama, the normalization of relations, was not an effort by the United States, you know, to somehow break with the past and has no designs on Cuba. But rather, this was an attempt by the U.S. with Obama concentrating the thinking and the strategic orientation of a certain section of the U.S. ruling class, as I said, to develop a new approach to subordinating Cuba rather than relying on economic isolation, military pressure. Now, Obama was calling for the opening up, but this opening up was designed to sink the fangs of U.S. corporations and banks into Cuba once again, and to try to create the conditions so that Cuba would be breaking from its relationship with Venezuela and could be a more cooperating on a dependent, dominated basis with the U.S. in certain kinds of ways. So what Obama was doing was to normalize, but normalize was in the service of resubjugating Cuba. But here it was being done through more indirect means, and that's the policies and the approach that Obama was taking. You know, that now is up in the air because Trump appears to have, and we have to find out more about this, but Trump, you know, he's going to be unfolding this, but Trump wants to exact far greater concessions in any kind of interaction with Cuba. And rather than trying to work with a regime in Cuba to subjugate it through economic channels, through banks and foreign investment, the tourism, and as I said, Cuba has recreated the conditions of dependency under the Castro leadership, and tourism is now the first or second source of revenue for Cuba, and prostitution is reappearing. But Trump wants to keep that diplomatic economic isolation in place, and they want to actually get rid of. That seems to be the tack that they want to continue to get rid of that regime in power. And finally, there is the question, Michael, of Trump and fascism. You've had discussions about this on the show, and the Cuban exile movement and the reactionary role that that plays, you know, the anti-Castro forces in the U.S. These forces, right, who are not accepting of any kind of normalization, are actually an important component of the shock troops, the fascist shock troops that are part of this whole Trump fascist agenda. So this, too, is part of the complexity of the situation. So there you have this difference between Obama and Trump, but both of them represent the interest of U.S. imperialism, and both are programs and policies to resubjugate. But there are these kinds of differences that I'm outlining. And I think the important lesson here is really that the world, the people of Cuba and the people of the world need revolution. The world cries out for revolution. We talk often on your show and others about the horrible state of the planet, the refugee crisis, 60 million people, the fact that 300,000 African children die each year because they don't have access to malaria pills, to malaria medications that won't be sold because that's not a profitable market. The epidemic of mass incarceration, what's happening to the planet, global warming. Revolution is needed, and there's no shortage of heroism and determination on the part of the people in Cuba, in Greece more recently, Tahrir Square, Egypt, the history of struggle in Africa. But one of the lessons that really has to be drawn home. And this is what Avakian has been emphasizing in his book, The New Communism, is the decisive role of leadership. Whether these struggles, with all their heroism and sacrifice, go forward, and whether they lead to liberation, that depends on leadership, on the outlook, the scientific understanding, the method and approach for understanding reality and transforming it. Leadership is decisive, and Fidel Castro is a concentrated expression of what happens when you have leadership that is not basing itself on scientific communism. You have the resubordination of that society to imperialism, and now the economy is in a highly crisis-ridden state. Venezuela, its main source of financial support, is itself now in crisis. It has its own monoculture, oil. So these are important lessons for anyone who cares about the future of humanity and the prospects of revolution. And I really would encourage people to read this new book, The New Communism by Bob Avakian, which really provides the foundation, not just for understanding the process of making revolution, but has come forward with an actual framework, the architecture to make the most liberating revolution that humanity demands, communist revolution.
All right, Raymond Lada, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, and I hope to be on again, and we'll follow this further.
Absolutely, man. Take care.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Raymond Lada. Raymond is an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. He's a political economist, author of the book America in Decline, and a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we've been talking about the death of Fidel Castro, U.S. imperialism, and what it's going to take to liberate the Cuban people. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Ashley Jennifer Parker, spokesperson for Veterans Stand for Standing Rock. And she's going to be talking with us about what went on this past weekend at Standing Rock and how all the vets are looking at this. So stay tuned.
Bibles, guns, and flags. Oh, rock me in the cradle, child, carry me to the grave.
Bibles, guns, and flags.
Pledge allegiance to the doctrine, know you're gonna be saved. Bibles, guns, and flags. Everybody fall in line, praise the Lord and do the time. Follow the rules, forget the truth. 21 gun salutes.
Welcome back. That was Sunny Meadows with Bibles, Guns, and Flags.
There have been dramatic developments in the battle to stop the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline, DAPL, from endangering the water and violating the treaty rights of the Standing Rock Sioux. On Sunday, December 4th, the day before the federal and state authorities were threatening to evict water protectors from their camp near the Standing Rock Reservation, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced the Department of the Army will not approve an easement that would allow the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline to cross under the Missouri River in North Dakota. And that decision effectively blocks, for now, the completion of the pipeline on its current route. But one thing is for sure, while there's a lot of things that need to be understood about just exactly what did happen and what it means, the U.S. government would not have backed off on approving the final completion of the DAPL had it not been for the heroic and inspiring resistance at Standing Rock. And one very important part of that was the presence and the rallying of thousands of veterans, of U.S. military veterans, standing with the people of the Standing Rock Reservation. And here to talk with us about this is Ashley Jennifer Parker. And Parker is the head of press and media for the group Veterans Stand for Standing Rock. Parker, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Good to see you anyway.
Good to see you too.
Well, let's jump into this. What was your reaction? Obviously, the big news now is what happened on Sunday. What was your reaction to that?
Well, obviously, it's a huge win for us. Speaking to the tribe, this is the one thing that they've always stood fast and said they wanted. They wanted the Army Corps to deny this easement. That was their main mission statement of being there. And so now this has happened, and this is fantastic news. However, what's even more upsetting is that after this amazing thing happened, Energy Transfer Partners came out with a statement late in the night on Sunday at 11 p.m. stating that they were going to disregard the Army Corps' statement, and they were just going to continue to drill anyway and pay whatever fines that causes them. They're going to finish this pipeline.
You know, that's interesting because that's kind of, that concentrates the high stakes that are going on here in relation to this, where you have, you know, you do have, you had so many people come together from all walks of life to come out there. You had so many different tribes of Native peoples coming together. People hadn't gotten along for quite some time, came together and they stood to oppose this. And people from all over the country and people from all over the world had their eyes glued to this and in one way or another supported the struggle of the Native people. And then to have veterans, U.S. military veterans, come out the way they did in a very powerful stance and say the way you guys did. You came out and you said, to hell with this. We're not going to allow this to go down. We're going to stand with these people. What motivated that? First, tell people what happened, how that happened.
Well, Michael A. Wood Jr. and Wesley Clark Jr. Were friends, and they had decided they wanted to go with a small group of veterans. They're both activists in their own rights. And they decided they wanted to go, and so they started a GoFundMe campaign, and it ended up taking off, and we raised over $1 million in 22 days. It's been fantastic. Donations are still pouring in, which is fantastic for us as well because we're still there and we still have a lot of work to do. And so basically when this took off, it ended up becoming an idea to take more than just a couple of veterans, take a big group of veterans. So they opened up an online roster, and then they had over 2,000 people respond, and I was one of those people that responded. So I just decided to go as a volunteer, and I wanted to go to Standing Rock and stand in solidarity. And as things progressed, I ended up becoming head of press and media, so here I am. But the idea behind it was that when you take an oath of enlistment for the military, you end up saying that you are sworn to protect all enemies, foreign and domestic, and you're sworn to protect the Constitution. And that means the First Amendment. That means freedom of speech and the right to peacefully assemble. And these people are peacefully assembling on their own land. There are obviously legality issues now. People are saying it's the federal land, et cetera. But how many times have we taken their land? There's a 1851 Laramie Treaty that's like the original. And this is supposed to be their land, and this is where their burial sites are, and this is important land to them. And they are a peaceful and a prayerful people, and you're telling them that you're going to dig through and unearth their burial grounds, as well as put in a pipeline that actually will definitely break and probably poison not only their water with an oil spill, but the water for 18 million people that live downstream of the Missouri River. That's 18 million people in the middle of America that need to wake up and realize that this isn't going to happen to them. It just hasn't happened yet. And you have the Native Americans again standing up for your rights and saying, please don't do this. So the Native Americans have one of the highest concentrations of veterans that exist within an ethnic people in America. And so they are very useful in that way of connecting between the veterans and the natives. So we had a lot in common to be able to talk about. And so they offered themselves to, the veterans offered themselves to the Native Americans, and the Native Americans offered for us to come. And so we wanted to go and stand in solidarity, and that's how it all started.
Tell me this, just to get a sense of this, I mean, was it something that like started off as sort of a more manageable sort of, okay, well, there's a number of people we know that are going to come. And then it seemed to mushroom because there's thousands there now, right? And there's many thousands probably waiting to go.
Yes. So I think it is ironic that it has actually been manageable at 2,000 people. We definitely have had, I think, 1,500 that we bust in, and definitely 500 more that have probably come on their own. It's hard to get a final head count. I've told the media, and they've all asked very specific questions, and I've said this is basically a war zone on American soil that no one's talking about. This is a self-sufficient situation. You have to go up there self-sufficient. You have to know what's going on, and you have to be able to take care of yourself. They have an extreme blizzard right now. No one's getting any comms out. We can't get a hold of anyone. It's a very tough situation, but it's something that really makes such a difference because you have that many people that are willing to go that far to get there. So far, what I've heard is that a lot of people showed up, and we actually got what we wanted.
You know, it's interesting, too, because you also raised, as you were mentioning earlier, you also raised $1 million to get people there and as part of supporting this project. That indicates something very, very significant in the country in relation to the stand that the vets were taking.
Yes. Well, I think it's very clear that the American people are definitely behind this, which is a fantastic thing to see. And as they should be. I think that anyone who has a logical thought process realizes that we should be moving away from crude oil, and we should be doing everything we can not to build any sort of infrastructure that is going to end up with the possibility, the more than the possibility, that it will absolutely have some sort of an incident. So there have been hundreds and hundreds of incidents for the last 30 years from these pipelines all across the country, and they're very rarely reported. So, you know, they span many miles of sort of uncharted territory, and often you don't see when these things happen, but they do happen all the time. And this is something that is actually a danger to most of our society. But here, where it's located, going underneath the Missouri River, this is what the Native Americans are trying to say, is that this is our drinking water. The moment this starts to leak, we won't be able to have any water. And then 18 million people downstream won't either. So why is no one paying attention?
Mm-hmm. And in terms of that, when you actually have people, when you have a whole segment of people, just in general, a whole segment of people coming to stand with the Native peoples, to stand up against this. I mean, it's been very interesting. All the Hollywood people that have come out and done things and really aiming to speak to and with and to stand with the people there. At the same time, you have veterans who, you know, look, quite frankly, the U.S. military has not been a friend, even though, you know, you had mentioned, OK, there's more Native peoples that have been in the military than any other section of population. But there's actually or a tremendous number of them anyway. But at the same time, the U.S. military throughout its history has had a very, very, very bad history in terms of its relationship with the Native peoples from the very beginning of the country.
Absolutely. That was something that was very important to us. We actually had a ceremony to open the weekend that we were going to be up there. And we asked permission to join and to stand in solidarity. And then we apologized. So Wesley Clark Jr., I have a video of him as well, apologizing for all of the atrocities the military has committed against the Native Americans. And we were welcomed. So, you know, we wanted to do this with the utmost respect of them. And this was for them, to help them and stand in solidarity with them and support them. And it wasn't about us, and it's not supposed to be about us. And I think that it's unfortunate that it's very clear that the media has only shown up now when we're there. So it's a double-edged sword. We're glad to be of service. This is obviously the plan. The plan was to get more people interested and get people involved. But it's so sad that this has been happening for months, that these Native Americans have been brutalized, and no one has cared until now just because the veterans have finally stood up and said something. But it does, you know, make us feel great that obviously something's happened. But we wish that people would be paying attention to something this serious on American soil months before we had to show up.
Mm-hmm. And part of it, though, I do think that the power of this, again, the power of this, of the veterans themselves coming out, you guys coming out and standing with this struggle and with these people, it does, you know, yes, it's like, you know, as you're saying, okay, it should have been paid attention to a lot more. People should have really been paying attention to it earlier on. But at the same time, the fact that this actually really upped the ante, for one, for the company that's trying to put in the pipeline, and two, for the U.S. government in terms of what were they actually going to do, the Army Corps of Engineers, Obama, all of these people, what were they going to do in the face of this? And it really put things up it ratcheted things up to a very high level. And I think, as I said in the beginning, eyes all over the world were focused on this, in no small part due to the arrival of the vets this weekend, in fact.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's part of the idea behind the process. Was we saw the brutality going on. We saw the violence. I mean, they are spraying elderly women of the tribe in the front lines with pepper spray. They are beating people with batons. They are sicking dogs on these people and having them bite people. They are using water cannons in 28 degree Fahrenheit weather. This is not your average response to anyone who is unarmed and who is protesting. So when we see all this happening, we thought, what if we were a front line of veterans and we're, you know, a protected class in society? Americans respect their veterans, and especially the militarized police and the police in general, they will respect their veterans as well, because a lot of them are also veterans. And for them to, can they behave that way? If we go up there and we stand on the front line, will they spray us with water cannons? Will they spray us with tear gas? Will they use the rubber bullets on us? And if they did, then what would America do? Because it's really showing who's on the right side of the situation. The idea is to go as a peaceful, unarmed movement and to be there and to just put ourselves in that moment and see what happens. It's not about attacking the police, but obviously if two people on two sides of the war of attrition line do not actually come to the line and see what happened, then there's really no point in calling it any event. So it's not about creating a problem, but it's about allowing the event to occur so that we can see what happens.
Well, tell me this. When the vets arrived at the scene, it was what, a few days ago?
Yes, they started arriving a couple days ago, trickling in, and a lot of people came on the 3rd, and then everyone was supposed to be there on the 4th for the major mm-hmm. muster.
Now, were there some actions between the canceling of the pursuit of the pipeline and when the vets got there? Were there was engagements?
There was a lot of discussion between the leadership of our movement and the authorities. Michael Awad Jr. is a former police officer from Baltimore. He wanted to reach out to the authorities. He wanted to be in touch. Wesley Clark Jr., the same thing. They both have been working really hard to have a resolution to this and to have a de-escalation of the situation. No one wants to see violence happen. That's why we're going up there in the first place. But what we can't seem to understand is why this hasn't been already dealt with and already having these, you know, talks with the tribe leaders. I mean, they say that they've had them, but obviously the tribe doesn't feel that way, because the tribe wouldn't be there if they felt that they were being listened to. So that is the point. So what we did is we went up, and I believe that there were a couple of different things that happened, but nothing was an engagement scenario. There were a couple little pockets of people. They went to the bridge. They wanted to see what was going on. They wanted to offer an ability to speak. And the reaction from the police has unfortunately seemed to be a lot of propaganda still. Their Facebook page and their Twitter, they come out with these videos that make them look like they've never done anything wrong and like they're the most calm-headed people that exist. And I've seen other videos of what they've done, and it just doesn't make any sense. Because if you were a calm-headed person, you wouldn't treat people like that. I would also like to mention the Bundy Militia, because they were a group of white armed men who took over a federal property that was a wildlife refuge in Oregon. And they were treated with the utmost respect. They were allowed to get their mail. They were allowed to go out to get food. They were not threatened in any way. They were not attacked. They were not brutalized. So this is something that is so clear that we're doing incorrectly to these Native American protesters who are water protectors, who are standing there unarmed and peacefully. And you take that and you compare it to what happened with the Bundy Militia, who then ended up getting away with everything in the courts. And you're wondering why people are being arrested over there, why you're having these issues, why you're having the brutality. It doesn't make sense. And it's just the same empirical racism that we have in this country continuing.
We're talking with Ashley Jennifer Parker, spokesperson for Veterans Stand for Standing Rock. And we're talking about the thousands of veterans who have come to support the Native people in their struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I was going to say is that when you look at this in terms of what's actually been done here, and even the fact that you use the term militarized police, that says something about the situation and what's at stake for the system overall. And then these two sides, the
right.
militarized police, and then you have the people who are opposing the assault, the genocidal assault, the continuation of a genocidal assault against their lives, and all the people that are standing with the Native peoples, they're not the militarized opponents.
Right. And that's part of the point. The point here is that I think it's actually a bigger picture issue. It's a horrible situation of what's happened. But if you think about it, these are militarized police paid for by the government and or by the pipeline itself. There's a $3.8 billion project. This is capitalism at its finest. But this is the capitalism taking over the law in this country in order to complete a pipeline. So you have the American citizens, you have not only the American citizens in general, but you have the Native American citizens who are on their land saying, I do not want this completed, and I'm going to stand here peacefully and ask you not to do so. And they are being brutalized. So I think for the future, what we're looking at in our government and in our country needs to be very clear that if you continue to stand peacefully against something and you can be brutalized against by the militarized police who do not believe as you do, that's no longer freedom of speech. That becomes a police state and that becomes an authoritarian government. So this is what we're worried about in the future. And this is why we take it so seriously, because we have seen other countries where that is the norm and we don't want that to become America. And I think that's something that a lot of people are missing about the entire situation. It's a really bigger picture and there's a lot of layers to this story.
You know, when we're talking about the situation overall, as you're just making the point, there's also, though, this point that even as the decision was made on Sunday that they would not continue with the pipeline, and supposedly now a lot of things, the way it's been reported is, well, this is all fine. This settles it. This is a great victory. And you were mentioning that actually you were very disturbed by some of the things that you heard in the aftermath of that, which actually points to something about we can't actually just say, okay, we won. There's nothing to fear. There's nothing to stand up but to be vigilant around. And let's talk about that a little.
Right. So I think one of the major things is that at 11 p.m. at night on Sunday, after the announcement against the easement, because it was denied, came out with the Army Corps, the Energy Transfer Partners company who owns the Dakota Access Pipeline came out and said they are going to drill and build this pipeline anyway. They're almost to completion. They have built the entire thing except for this small stretch just underneath the Missouri River. This is why this has been the event that it has been. This is the last moment for them. They've been trying to finish this for a while. So for them to then say that they're going to disregard what's come out of the Obama administration. They said that the Army Corps statement they believe was worded in such a way that it meant that it was only a political decision, that it wasn't actually binding. And then you have the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners who's invested $1.53 million into Trump's campaign. And you wonder if they're just waiting for Trump to take office because they know that he's going to support it. There were conflicting reports from Bloomberg and others that said that Trump had an investment of $50,000 to up to $2 million in the pipeline himself with the company. Then there were reports that he'd sold that and divested everything. But at the same time, if you are that close with someone who is a CEO of a company that wants to complete a $3.8 billion pipeline and you're president of the United States, I mean, I think we've seen so far what he's going to do when it comes to business. He's going to make things happen for people. So that's a really scary thing, because then the militarized police will be working for our actual government as well, because that's something the president would want. So what I'd love to see is this be taken care of completely, 100% energy transfer partners stand down and say that they are no longer going to finish this pipeline. I wish they would find another way to make money. They don't need to be involved in fracking and oil transfer and natural gases and all of this stuff. I mean, these are things that we have established in science that are not good for ourselves and for our planet and for our children. So I don't understand why anyone who has kids and who understands anything about environmental protection issues would want to have this pipeline completed. It just doesn't make any sense.
See, that's just it. So much of the system doesn't make sense to normal people, but the system itself is driven by the need to get this profit, the need to get this oil, the need to carry out their military maneuvers all over the world, that and to run the world and actually to constantly go after the greatest rate of profit they can, no matter who they have to kill,
right,
slaughter, or whatever.
Which is actually part of the ironic part of the veterans coming in, is that a lot of these veterans had gone over to Iraq and Afghanistan and they were fighting brown people for oil. And now they are standing up for brown people against oil. So it's actually this really interesting full circle situation. And I think it's actually the right side of the argument. And I think it always has been. And I think that's the problem. I think people don't realize what's actually going on in society. I think they have a very small worldview, and it's unfortunate. And I wish people would research more, find out more, travel more, speak to more people, and get other insights into other situations, because they don't spend the time anymore to talk about current affairs with most people. And I think that that's really what's lacking in American society today, is that knowledge seeking.
Now, one of the things that came out in relation to all this as this happened was that you had this op order, right? Operational order. And it basically said, we're coming here, we're committed to be here, we're coming here to point out where the heart of evil is.
Yes, I did not write that.
I liked it. I liked it a lot, okay?
There are definitely people involved in the movement who are writing a lot of things, and it's great. And I think it's serious because it is a moment where we could turn society for the better. And I do think it is an evil situation, definitely. And I think sometimes the hyperbole gets to be something where if you say something too loud that most other people just shut off listening. So that's my hesitation in using those exact words. But this is obviously something very serious, and this needs to be looked at, and this needs to be examined and understood as the very serious situation that it has been for months. And for people to sort of not take the time to really fully understand the situation. I get a lot of calls and I hear a lot of things about people saying, but the pipeline's going to bring so many jobs to the area, this is a good thing, et cetera. And it's like, yeah, for 5 minutes, there'll be jobs. And then this thing is going to take away jobs. All the truckers that were driving the oil across the country is now going to be piped across the country. Don't you understand that the whole point is a way for the company who owns this to make more money and to pay less people? So this becomes an oligarchy. And that's the problem that we're seeing, is that this is where we're headed in our society. And we need to make sure that that stops. And people need to have more of an idea that a worst case scenario is absolutely possible and it is probable. And that's the issue that no one's really paying attention to. They think that everyone who says anything serious against our current president-elect, anything going forward in the government, anyone who talks about the government in a poor way is actually a conspiracy theorist who's not letting anyone have a chance, et cetera. And I think that the time for chances is well over. This is something that we need to actually look at on a bigger picture scale and take initiative on and make sure that nothing keeps continuing as it's been.
There is this point, again, as I said, this remarkable thing of, and you mentioned this, and I was just thinking of it as you were talking. I was listening to you, but I was thinking of it as you were talking as well. The point that you made about the veterans, of you folks, that you went into the military for whatever reason. It didn't have to be high, you know, high-spirited patriotism. Some people went into it for a job. Some people went into it just because their life really sucked when they're doing what they were doing, and they were just looking for something to do. But the basic thing is that everybody, and even when you're looking at like the way this, the incoming government is shaping up, where you have the guy, what's a Mad Dog Mattis, who ran the Fallujah assault, that genocidal assault against the people of Fallujah. You know, you have all these things coming up, and to have, again, to have veterans who, as you said, have fought in wars from, I don't know if you have people from before Vietnam, but from Vietnam on, it was definitely something where some people began to understand what was really at the heart of this. And I think it's so damn significant and really has a very important role it's played in terms of helping people to understand what's at the heart of this. When you have all these veterans who once fought like hell for this country because they were told to, and whether they learned some stuff or whether they learned it after they got out, whenever you guys learned some things, that you actually had to draw a line here.
and to say, as we were just talking about, that there is a heart of evil here. And right. this is something we have to stand up against. And I think that's so damn significant.
Absolutely. And I think that that's actually the point of the movement. The movement wants to stay and continue to do other things as well once this is taken care of. We're going to stay in Standing Rock until this is taken care of. We want to make sure that we're there. There is actually a contract that's supposed to expire on January 1st for the Dakota Access Pipeline. If there isn't oil flowing by that date, supposedly the contract to build the entire pipeline is null and void. So I think that's part of the idea to stay back and continue to hold camp at this moment. But the idea for us as a movement, for Veterans Stand for Standing Rock, we want to just do what Veterans Stand for. And we want to stand for something at all times. And we want to continue this movement and this grassroots idea for what's right in this country. So hopefully that will continue. And hopefully after Standing Rock is won officially, hopefully we can stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. We can move on to other things that will definitely be needed, because obviously this is a society that needs something like this and needs us to go do this.
You know, I think it's really important what you're saying. And I think in particular, the point of, look, it's very, very important and very significant that people seem to have won this portion of the battle in a certain sense right now. At this time. But where it goes, as you were cautioning earlier about the company and what it's actually got up its sleeve, but also what the U.S. government will do. You know, we have this whole new monster coming in, this for real fascist who's actually going to be sitting as the president.
Don't get me started.
Well, you know, it's very heavy on us, because here's the thing. You know, I've been reading all these books about Germany and when the Nazis came in. And, you know, one of the things that happened is that you have people like Trump. And you have people like them that people go, oh, he's not a fascist. He's a kook. He's kind of crazy, but he's not, you know, come on. One of the things that people don't realize, that even though the Germans had killed tens of millions of people and they slaughtered tens of thousands of communists and they had slaughtered all the Jewish people, all these things that they did, there were still people who actually looked at the German government as legitimate. The German government never lost its legitimacy in the eyes of a lot of people in Germany, many people. That's how they wrote out the whole atrocities that they were doing.
And that's still true. And I think that's still true in America. You see the alt-right who are doing the same thing, who are saying that, you know, Heil Trump. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. This is absolutely mind-blowingly crazy. People need to wake up and look at the situation and see that it is definitely happening and we have to stop it. I think that that's something, that's a whole nother conversation. But I think it's something that this is the starting point for that, where we can show that actually standing up and being peaceful and saying no to something is possible, and hopefully that it can make a real difference. I mean, this Army Corps denial of the easement has been wanted for months, and it hasn't happened. And here we go, and we're up there, and it happens the day after we arrive. So it is a fantastic win for us and a fantastic one for the tribes. And we definitely want to make sure that that is something that can continue in general. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know.
Actually, one thing to see what you think about this, and part of it as, again, building on what you said about what's in the future for this movement, and in particular for this vets movement, and what's developed around this. The U.S. government has a 400-year record of refusing to respect the land of Native peoples and violating treaties. And so it's really good that you guys are saying, we're not pulling out, yay, we won, you know, let's, let, you know,
right.
split. But what the statement from the Corps of Engineers means, and the thing that the statement that basically shutting down the oil pipeline for the moment, what it means short and long term will be in large part defined by how strong the struggle stays and grows, and people need to be vigilant with that in mind. So I wanted to ask you what you thought about that, because that's actually sort of the heart of what we're getting at here. Is like, you know, we've come to this point, but damn, people better be vigilant, because nobody knows what it actually means.
Right. And I think that's something that is true across our society at the moment, and that's why we want to stay, and that's why we want to continue to do things as well. But we need people who are actually able to stand up and actually realize when things aren't normal and say something about it. And that's a hard thing to do. I mean, you get your friends or your family or your coworkers that don't want to hear your opinion, if you're a dissenting opinion, and they don't want to hear it. You're turned down and you're told to shut up. And you have to rise above that and continue to be as vocal as possible and try to turn the ones who are not fully gone. And the ones who are fully gone, we need to be very wary of. I just think that there's a lack of understanding of human beings for your neighbor. So this progressive idea of movement shouldn't be about your tax dollars and, you know, your issues with social morals, I guess. So it shouldn't be about social morals and your tax dollars and what you're going to spend to help people with welfare. It should be about making sure that, like, you have a society that's built upon taking care of everyone else, because everyone needs a safety net. And we need to have something where if something is actually going this badly for a group of people, if they are being brutalized like this, we have a group of people who can go up there and say, look at this, stop it. This is not right. And that's the way that we should be living. And that's the way I think Americans were raised. I mean, America was the land of the free and home of the brave. And we should all be very brave and stay very free. And I think the way to do that is by being as vocal as possible against any opposing forces and anyone who's going to bring an authoritarian fascist dictatorship to our country, which is probably what's happening.
I'll tell you what, I think it's really important what you've been saying. I also say, we got to have you back again to talk about this thing about the land of the free and home of the brave, because at the same time, as I was saying, there isn't a damn treaty that they've had with Native peoples that they've honored. They've decimated people over centuries. They've slaughtered many millions of people.
As Michael says, he says, you know, which time is this that they're breaking the treaty? Which time is this that they're telling them that this is not their land? This is their land. Like, this is their land, and we've taken their land away, and we've given them a small little national park size land and called it their reservation. I mean, we are a horrible people to have done this to our Native Americans. They deserve the utmost respect. They are a national treasure. And here we are trying to desecrate their burial grounds and also not listen to them when it comes to actual water protection, which is what they're calling themselves, water protectors. It's really important to them to protect this water for everyone else in America. So here they are saying, we're trying to save all of you and none of you care. And then all of this is being done for capitalism. It's the true American way at this moment, which is really what's so sad, because that's not really the American way. And I think people at home forget that. And I think people say, well, that's what America's all about. Well, no, America's actually about helping your neighbor and accepting everyone and letting everyone come through our country and letting everyone come through our borders. And obviously that's something that we've really lost. And who's really American anymore?
Although, again, and we should talk about this in the future, but there is a point about what America really stands for. When you look at the history of America, the history that we're taught in schools about the wide open arms, the loving people, it's bull.
It is, absolutely.
And we need to understand that the ugliness that America is showing today is true all the way through its history.
Absolutely, which is why we should try to become what we learned we were in school.
Or better.
Ideally, yes.
All right. If people want to know more about Veterans Stand for Standing Rock, what do they do?
So we have a Twitter. It's @VeteransStand, and that's probably the best way to reach us.
Parker, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank everybody who worked on the show today. I want to thank all of our guests today. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going out now with a little bit more from Sunny Meadows and Bibles, Guns, and Flags.
Bibles, guns, and flags. Get yourself a uniform and join the parade. Yes, Gideon and Lucifer will lead the crusade. With the Bibles, guns, and flags. Sailor suits and suits and ties, black trench coats and pinstripes, vestments, collars, furs and wraps, backwards baseball caps. Bibles, guns, and flags. Oh, into the breach with the bolt engaged. A finger on the trigger and release the rage. Of Bibles, guns, and flags. The rap and video games, Hollywood violence is to blame. Got a sense of the World Wide Web, keep a loaded pistol neath your bed.